This episode is brought to you by IVP. Friendships are difficult. How can we build real friendships that are life-giving and last the test of time? In his book, Enduring Friendship, author Brian Loritz offers pastoral insight into the Book of Philemon and offers a unique perspective on building and rebuilding long-lasting friendships. And as a listener of this podcast, you can receive Enduring Friendship for 25% off when you use the promo code IVPOD25, that's IVPOD25, at ivpress.com.
IVP produced this podcast as a public service. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your mental health professional or another qualified health provider for any questions you may have related to mental health conditions. Talk to me about, if you feel comfortable, to the extent you feel comfortable, a time where you have had trouble getting out of bed. I'll start. For me, it was this morning. I had a very difficult time getting out of bed this morning.
Yeah. It is funny that you said that, because this morning also, I think, would be the last time for me. I mean, this morning was more difficult to get out of bed. I did it, but it was harder than it was yesterday.
Tish Harrison Warren is an author, priest, and public theologian based in Austin, Texas. She's the author of several books, including Prayer in the Night and Liturgy of the Ordinary. And she writes for the New York Times as a regular columnist. This conversation with Tish is encouraging for a number of reasons, but one is just hearing from somebody who's so well established, who's so accomplished, who's so thoughtful and intelligent and spiritually grounded, confess her own struggles and share her own difficulties with getting out of bed and with going through the day. And just the practical advice that she gives, it's simple, it's practical, but it's manageable. And I think that actually encapsulates what she offers in our conversation. Simple, practical, but manageable ways of getting out of bed. Struggle with worrying about the systems that govern our lives sometimes, but more often than not, my struggles have to do with what's going on in my head, which is less about systems than it is about me. There certainly have been times where I've been frustrated with systems and structures and principalities and the smallness of myself and my role in the world, my inability to have the agency to change things can be overwhelming. And sometimes that just means going along with what's asked of us, even though it's not what we want to do or what we know to be good, but we know that it's what we have to do to provide for our families, to provide for our friends and our community. We've got to play along with whatever systems are in place. It can be difficult to be joyful in those moments, but I think where we can find a sense of joy and purpose is recognizing that even by being a cog in the machine, we're turning wheels that will help those that we love. And that's got to be enough some days. I asked you on because this is, although it's a podcast about mental health, I would call it a podcast about a humanist podcast, a Christian humanist podcast. And what I mean by that
All right, that's rad. I'm down with that.
Are you down with that? Yeah. That's good, because you're already on.
I would consider myself a Christian humanist, so...
That's great.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, perfect. So with that in mind, you wake up and you have these thoughts running through your head. I'm going to have to feed these kids of mine. My kids need to be fed. I've got to write this article for the New York Times that people are going to give me grief over. Yeah. no matter what I say.
Are those the things
that keep you stuck in bed?
Those are some of the things. Yeah. I have to produce. I have to produce something creative. Something that I deal with as a writer a lot, as a creative kind of artist-y type, but also as a Christian and a parent. Mm. I'm just going to say this about writing, but just know that this is kind of a metaphor for everything else in my life. There is no inspiration, and I am exhausted, and I feel really, really dry, like spiritually or creatively, and I don't know what it's a really difficult sensation for me to explain, but it just feels like I'm having to like push. It's the difference between like all writing is hard work, right? It's never not hard work, but there's a hard work that's like dancing or running hard. And then there's a hard work that's like pushing a piano upstairs. Yeah. And what I'm describing is like the pushing the piano upstairs. It just feels like there's this, like it's this insurmountable task. I mean, I face this all the time. Sometimes really the right thing to do is to just press in and keep going. And sometimes the right thing to do is to listen to that sense of resistance and stop. And there is no discernible difference to them. Like there's no light on the dashboard. There's nothing that tells me one over the other. And so it's so hard for me to discern. And I experienced this week because Mondays are usually really difficult writing days for me for various reasons, coming off the weekend, but also my deadline for the Times is Tuesday morning. So I really have to get quite a bit done on Monday. And so Mondays are dark, hard days for me typically. And I just knew that morning I prayed. I spent some time in prayer on the back porch, and it was the Monday after Easter. And I was like, I can't do it. I'm not going to get this done. And anyway, long story short, I had a daughter that needed to go to a doctor because of an ear infection. And so I ended up taking my other kids and we did something that one of my kids needed to do for school. And then I took them to a bookstore and I read books to my youngest, and my oldest read books on her own. And we just had a great time. And then I came back to work at noon and I got more done in the next 3 hours than I would normally get in 8 hours of work. I just was ready to go. It was absolutely the right thing to stop then. But then there's other times that I face all the time where I feel like stopping and I need to keep going. So it's a larger metaphor for when do you get out of bed and when do you just go, I'm exhausted, it's hard, and I need to stay in bed. When do you press on and when do you not? And that's a really, really hard thing for me. And it gets into larger questions of kind of the difference between depression and asadia and how do you treat one and the other. But anyway, it feels like that's the trick to me, is like two different, it's literally the opposite impulse. Do you double down on discipline or do you double down on rest? And sometimes one's right and sometimes the other's right. And you just don't know. Like, it's a matter of wisdom, not law.
And sometimes in my experience, one will slip into another. So I'll feel like, okay, I'm just going to take a break. I can't. So right now I'm in this dry spell in writing because I'm just not going, my headspace is not a good headspace. So I wake up and I don't have that creative, I don't know, spark. That makes it sound like it's magic or something. But as you say, it's work. But I just feel blocked off from that creative part of me. But I think I need to do the first thing that you said, which is actually just go through the motions, just like show up. And some days getting to work is like my victory. And it's interesting because like once I get there, I can start moving and doing things and then life happens and I start to feel better. But it's that initial time in bed where I feel the anxiety of the day and how insurmountable it feels and how sometimes just how apathetic I'm towards it. And that's what makes it difficult to get up for me today. That was today, but I showed up. I took a shower and I showed up.
I'm glad you did. We would not be having this conversation.
No, or so, we'd be having it at my house. Yeah.
Yeah, you'd be in bed and I'd be like, this is a little awkward.
This is a strange podcast. I did not sign up for this. Yeah. No, I made it to my office. And so that's a victory for today. And I'm proud of that.
Yeah. I'm grateful for you doing that. It's honestly, it's an act of love, right? Getting out of bed is an act of love for the people around us, including me today. So thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. You're welcome. And it's interesting. Prayer was a big part of it too. But there came an end to my prayer. For me, it was praying, you know, it was this prayer of, Lord, help me to do the next thing, right? Which was get out of bed and go downstairs and eat breakfast and do these things. And I've had many opportunities or many experiences where I don't have a 3-year-old anymore. My youngest is 7, but she'll do similar things where she'll come in and be that voice of life and just say, you need to get up. Come on, daddy, get up. And those are powerful moments because it can feel like there's this, I think momentum is such a powerful thing. If you have positive momentum, this sounds like I'm going to be a life coach now. But it's true. Like if you have momentum in life and you're moving, you can keep, sometimes it's easy just to keep moving. But when there's no inertia and you're just lying in bed and there's this huge piano you're shoving up the stairs, if you get out of bed, being reminded by another person about what you're getting up for is, I think, very powerful. So in my book, I like to talk about mental affliction rather than mental health. And part of the reason for that is I want to explode the way we think about mental health because sometimes we think about it in two clinical terms. And we talk about people who are diagnosed, and which is great, and it's an important conversation. And I'm glad that we're lowering the stigma surrounding that. But sometimes, you know, you began this answering that first question about, you know, when you've had trouble getting out of bed by saying, well, sometimes I'm just tired. I'm physically tired. And that can be a mental affliction too, right? So that's why I like that phrase, mental affliction, is it's, you know, a kind of suffering that happens in your mind. Sometimes it's because of life struggles. Sometimes it's because of trauma. Sometimes it's because of a mental illness or disorder. But it could be all kinds of things. And part of the premise of this book is that it's basic to human experience. So that's why I started this by talking about Christian humanism, because it's about what does it mean to be a humanist, to be a human.
Yeah, I love that, by the way. I just think that's a super helpful reframing. Because mental health makes it real binary. So you are mentally healthy or click. You are diagnosed in your mental health. And that is just not the way that this works. I feel like there's a spectrum of mental affliction and mental, I don't know what the opposite of peace, I guess, or clarity that I feel like, it's on a spectrum and I move all over that spectrum in a given day. And I don't know if I've said this publicly, but I definitely tend towards kind of melancholy, mm-hmm. which is different than depression, but it's not, it is certainly, it's not like again, there's no light on the dashboard. It's not like a click. Oh, now I'm in depression instead of just melancholy. You know, like there's certainly, so this doesn't deny the fact that obviously there are mental health issues. People should see counselors and get medication and that sort of thing. But then it just names that it's not like there are those of us that are perfectly mentally healthy and then those of us on medication, and there is no overlap between those groups. Like we all experience levels of mental unhealth, like every single person in the world. And so I think mental affliction is a much better way of talking about this. Well done.
So what do you do? Do you tend to share when you're going through these periods of melancholy or they slip into depression? Do you tend to turn to certain people? And if so, who do you turn to? I want names and addresses. No, just, they have any openings actually?
That's helpful. All right. That's a good question. So, okay, I'm going to be very vulnerable. I wasn't sure how much to share on this podcast, but I will share.
Yeah,
but my family history has lots and lots of pretty intense depression in it that affected my life really significantly. I mean, adults in my family when I was a kid, and it's like generations of this struggle, where depression and mental health stuff was pretty. It's been pretty shaping of my life and my story. And my grandmother's family had 6 children in it. 3 of the 6 committed suicide. So, that was my grandmother. So I only knew one of them was, the rest of them died before I was born. But, and then even kind of from all sides of my family, we just have a lot of depression, alcoholism, and I sort of won the whatever bad lottery. What's the opposite of the lottery with all of that? So because of that, I think because of that, just from I just am like very aware of my own mental state, and I just don't mess around with it. Like I just know how this can go. So, but I've never taken antidepressants, and I'm very open to doing that. My life's not over yet. Like I still very much might, but the way that I have handled that is when I feel like I'm struggling mentally or having an extra hard time getting out of bed for a long period of time or whatever, there are certain things that I turn to that I just have to turn to. I mean, it's like, it's the way that alcoholics call their sponsors. Like, I just know this is part of my life, like that I have to do it, or the way, I don't know, diabetics get insulin. Like, I just know that I have to do these things. So I tell my husband, and I have some friends that are close that I talk to, my best friend from college, I will talk to him about it. Or, I have just some like close friend Hannah, or we have a family we meet with every Tuesday night, and we just tell them like we eat dinner and then the kids go off and play, and we just tell them everything happening in our life, and they tell us what's happening in theirs. So it's kind of it is like counseling for free, but with friends. But we don't really give advice because we don't know what to do usually. So we just pray. But saying it out loud and people being like, that makes sense, or this is what's happening in my life, is helpful. And so that's the main thing. And then I go see counselors. So I don't have one right now because since we moved to Austin, we haven't reestablished, but I had a counselor in Pittsburgh. I actually talk about her, Ginger. I talk about her in my last book, Prayer in the Night. And she was phenomenal. I saw her for 4 years, pretty consistently, not every week, but pretty consistently. And then,
So this friendship that you have on Tuesday nights, this sounds fantastic. We had a family that was very close to us. They had to move, but we would do a lot of similar things. And did you have to be intentional about this?
Oh, we literally moved to the neighborhood we live in and bought the house we bought in order to do this.
That's beautiful. Okay. That makes me feel better because
it was extremely intentional. We called them and said, this is what we would like to do. But if you don't want to do this, tell us now because we don't want to
buy a house.
Right. We don't want to buy a house if you're not in. So they went and thought and prayed and came back and were like, we're in. And so we're like, okay. And so we literally moved. So yeah.
Were there any vows exchanged?
Nope, there's no vows. It would be great. I'm all for vows. Man, I wonder. I think if I brought it up right now, it would scare them. It would be it's the third date and you're asking me to marry you. But no, there's not been vows, but there's been commitment in the sense that we had a conversation, said, this is what we want this to look like. We've had multiple conversations about that and we are committed to that. So it's not like we never, ever miss it. I mean, between us, we have there's 5 children represented. So it's not uncommon for someone's vomiting. We can't do something or we can't. And we don't. We now have a rhythm where we share every other week. And then on the off weeks, we do something with our children, like play a game or something, because the kids wanted to be more involved. But no, there hasn't been vowels.
Yeah.
So it's fragile.
Though.
It could fall apart. We could get in a big fight or something, but we haven't so far. So yeah.
That's great. Yeah, that's great. I feel like at this stage, I'm 41, and at this point, if I'm not intentional about friendships, they're just not going to happen.
It's totally true. It's so true, and it's really hard because of that, but yeah. And, it's not just, part of the deal is, it's great to hang out with them, but we also have to intentionally decide to be honest with what's going on in our life. So if we've been fighting like cats and dogs all week, we can't get together and be like, things are good. The kids are well, let's say, we have to be like, this is what's actually happening. So that takes intentionality also. Oh,
after God. You do.
Oh, definitely. Yes.
Yeah.
So much so. Yes. Yeah. It's totally worth it, but it requires intentionality about being honest and about taking risk and about being real. Yeah.
How long have you guys been friends? How long does this trust take to build? How long have you known these people?
Well, that's an interesting question because we've known them for a long time. We met them in 2007. It's so funny. I didn't tell them. Maybe I should have asked them. I didn't know we were going to be talking about them. So that they have no idea they're going to be
names.
On this podcast.
That's all right.
But we met them in 2007 and then we were close friends. And then we ended up for a season. We were still friends. We were never not friends, but we just saw them a lot less. We went to different churches.
Sure.
Then we moved to another state for 4 years.
Right.
So we would sometimes see them, sometimes talk to them when we came back, but not all the time. And they certainly have friends that they would consider closer than us probably. There was a time we were away. And then after we moved back to Texas, we were wanting community. And it was difficult. We moved back in the middle of COVID. And so we had some friends here that we were close with, but one of them, I'm their kid's godparent and we're just tight. And then two of them moved, they left Texas. I still love them, but I will never forgive them. I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. I love them. They're doing what they're called to do. So, But because of that, we sort of were like, okay, we just sort of like lost a lot of our community and are needing to reestablish it intentionally. And so, like, I mean, I wasn't kidding that we really did kind of like just call these people who were not the people that we had like most stayed in touch with, but still loved and like sort of stayed in touch with, and said like, hey, we want to live more intentionally and we need people walking with us in life. Our children are similar age and we love you guys and trust you. Like, would you like step into this with us? So my husband actually, I think, came across this quote from the Clapham sect in England.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And they said, pick a neighbor before you pick a neighborhood. And so we just took it seriously. And like, we're like, we're picking these people as our neighbors. So, yeah, that's how it happened.
That's beautiful. I just, you know, I wonder as our communities get so fractured, if that kind of intentionality is going to be necessary. And I know for me, I've got people that I can call at the drop of a hat or text anytime. You know, I mentioned in the book, you know, there are a couple of guys that I've been able to call. You know, I'm having not an anxiety attack, because that's has a clinical definition, I think. I'm not sure. I'm not that kind of a doctor, but just a lot of anxiety, and I'll have to go teach a class. And it's like, I've got 5 minutes, and there are a couple of guys in my life who I can text or call almost at the drop of a hat because of their life circumstances, and they'll pick up and they'll be like, Alan, you're going to be okay. You can do this. Yeah. And that kind of friendship, and it's obviously, it's so much better when it's embodied, when it's in person, but even just the you know, I think a voice is embodied in a way that a text isn't. And
that's right. And I don't want to say, I mean, we have these friends, but I still have, we've, like you, because of my husband's going to grad school and being in the academy and being pastors, we've moved a lot. And so a lot of my close friends live in different states, you know. So so I do, yeah, I'll call. You know, I have good friends in Chicago. I have good friends in Pittsburgh. I have good friends in St. Louis. So I'll just call them a lot too. So,
Yeah. Are you a phone person?
I become a phone person.
Yeah.
You know, honestly, this gets a little like, it's hard to know when this is like Christian influencer name dropping and when this is like real friends. But Esau McCauley has made me a phone person because we became friends about 5 years ago. He's one of my very, very best friends. And he just calls like all the dang time. Like he just calls a lot and he doesn't text. And I didn't really like texting either. I mean, I'm just old enough where I'm like a little bit above a millennial. I'm like in that, whatever they call it, the crack, like I'm between X and I'm a zennial or whatever they call it. So, so I don't love texting and I especially hate it. I want to say this on a podcast we need to rebel against this, that I will have friends, especially if they're slightly younger than me, that text me, how are you? Or, and I'm like, how can I answer that by text? The only thing you can say by text is like good or bad. I understand they're trying to reach out, but it's a terrible, it's too much. I can't answer this by text is what is. So
yeah.
The point is, he made me realize, like, oh, yeah, you don't, I didn't even really like texting, but I don't have to. Like, I can call people. So I think he started it, and now I just call people all the time. And everyone's taken aback by it because nobody calls. So they're like,
yeah.
At first, when I started doing this, everyone was like, are you okay? What's wrong? Are you in a hospital? But now I just call people. So I call people, I send. I also send voice texts, especially with friends of mine that are single or don't have kids. They can only talk at night, and nights are really hard for me to talk because I'm like full on with the kids. So I usually talk during the day. So we miss each other. So we'll leave like voice text or Voxers or whatever. So yeah, that's a lot of detail about that question. But yes, I like the phone now. It's way better than texting. I'll say that.
No, I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense because, and I found that too. I was very adverse to talking on the phone. I used to, when I was a teenager, I did it all the time. It was like, oh yeah.
There was no other option.
There was no other option. There was no texting. But there was a period in my life where it was like, I really just don't want to talk on the phone. And then enough life crises happened where I had to depend on people. And now I'm like, no, talking on the phone to a friend. And people, I had friends move and I no longer had the convenience of just dropping by and talking to people. So I had to become a phone person. And now I'm grateful for it. And people's voices, I said earlier that it's a form of embodiment. Just hearing us, you know, certain friends' voices does something different than reading their texts or whatever, emails.
It's so true. And you can't, I mean, I text all the time, mostly to convey information, you know, can you pick up the kids from school, that kind of thing. But
right.
But you just can't, there's not tone with text, and tone is so important. And so, I mean, of course, we all know tone's important for meaning. You know, if you say, like, there's just things that can come across so harsh by text that are not meant harsh. But I mean, if we're talking about mental adversity, is that the right word? No. Affliction.
Yeah, sure.
Affliction.
I said affliction, but adversity. Adversity.
Tone is so important for, like, soothing our souls with that. I mean,
yes.
Hearing a friend be like, I love you and I'm praying for you and I'm here for you is really different than getting a text from a friend with those exact same words. And it's not that, of course, it's great to have a friend say they love you either way, but there's something like neurologically, biochemically that I think that responds to somewhat to hearing of human voice talk, you know, ask us, how are you, versus someone texting, how are you?
Yeah. And so that requires a level of intentionality too. You have to choose to call people rather than it just happening. So in your opinion, why get out of bed? This is my final question. Leave our listeners with some thoughts. Why should they get out of bed?
Well, I mean, some days you should stay in bed a little longer. I mean, you should eventually get out, but maybe there are, again, like maybe there's some days to give in to that a little bit, I think. Like, here's what I'm wrestling with. So there's this notion, right, of a sadia, which is a lot to get into right at the end of a podcast, but it's kind of, it's like spiritual torpor, T-O-R-P-O-R.
Mm-hmm. Yes, torpor.
It's translated sloth, but that's not a good translation. It's more like, well, the best definition I've heard of it is something like sadness that the good is hard. Like sadness that good in the world is difficult. You know, Evagrius of Pontus was the one who wrote about this most broadly. And Kathleen Norris has written a lot on it more recently. But it's basically like this, it is being difficult to get out of bed. Monks dealt with this so much. It's difficult to just keep going, to do the prayers when you're supposed to do them, to do your work when you're supposed to do them. And the response to Asadia is just doing the rule of life, just continuing to be in your cell doing prayer when you're supposed to do it, just continuing to show up and just do the work and tend the fire and harvest the field, whether you feel like it or not, just do it. So it's this pressing into discipline. There's other times, I think, where when we're dealing with depression, maybe, I also think sometimes we mistake depression for just genuine grief, just genuine sorrow, just genuine anxiety, because life is anxiety producing. Like, that is not something wrong with you. That's reality. It is difficult to be fragile in a fragile world and have everyone you love be fragile. Like, all of these things are real grief. And sometimes the response to that is really, I mean, the treatment for that, quote unquote, is the opposite of the treatment for Asadia. It's, instead of pressing in, it's taking the afternoon work off, going and getting a cup of coffee and reading a book for enjoyment, or walking through a beautiful park, or sitting and crying and letting yourself just feel it for a while. And I have done that. I schedule sometimes, you know, I'm going to let myself be as sad as I want to be for the next 72 hours. And I'm going to just, I don't usually have 72 hours, 48 hours. And I'm going to just let myself be sad and cry. I'm going to eat chocolate and I'm just going to be sad, like a breakup, but it's not usually over a breakup. It's over like a move or a loss of friendship or loneliness or whatever. I'm going to let myself feel this and I'm going to give myself permission. And then after whatever it is, 48 hours, like I have to take a shower and I have to keep going. Like I literally like will give myself permission to just don't do anything you don't feel like doing, because, and there's limits to that because of kids and stuff, but because I think there are times where like the solution is not to get out of bed. It's not, I mean, I do eventually get out of bed, but it is to cut yourself some slack and let yourself feel what you're feeling and let yourself journal about it and let yourself think about it and let yourself, you know, look at it, which is different than just plopping in front of the TV and zoning out for 48 hours.
Right.
But maybe you could do that for a little bit of that time. So why get out of bed? Like sometimes maybe don't. But the other thing is when it's, but I mean, eventually you need to get out of bed. So there's a ton of reasons for this. There's sort of quote unquote spiritual reasons, like God loves you and has a plan for your life. As cheesy as that sounds, it's true. And the plan involves getting out of bed. There's very pragmatic reasons, like kind of what you were saying, like you will feel better eventually if you keep going. Like you will, like you're... There is, David Wilcox has a song that it's called Down Inside Yourself. It's about these times of feeling really blue. And he says what he's dealing with, this physiological and illogical disguise, that it's, that it seems like this big existential dilemma, but he says, and it, what he really needs to do is get some sleep, take a shower, eat some broccoli, run a mile. And then it says you're just down inside yourself. So sometimes like getting out of your own head is, you're not going to get out of your own head if you don't get out of bed. Like you're just,
oh,
you're
man.
Not. So
that's good.
So some of it is pragmatic. I mean, I think the other thing is like, I feel like we're not allowed to say this, but I'm going to say it, is that
say it.
It's selfish to not get out of bed. There is a moral thing here of like, people in this world love you and need you. And if people are thinking, no, nobody needs me, it's just, that's just wrong. It's like, we need each other. Maybe people don't even know they need you yet, but like you are needed on this planet. Every person who gives in to despair makes it so much easier for the rest of us to give in to despair. Like we desperately need each other. And so some of this is for me, you know, pragmatic of like, I have these small human beings that need me and I have a spouse that needs me. But beyond that, like we have friends that need us. We have community. We have church people that need us. Yeah. We have the homeless people down the street need us. I mean, and so there is this sense of like, your life is not your own. I feel like I've read a book about that before. The reason I feel like we're not allowed to say this is there is a sense of like, oh, like we can talk about mental affliction as if we're sort of just like pure victims, in that.
Right.
And we don't want to like blame the victim in any way. And I don't want to blame the victim. That's not what I'm saying. But there is a sense, I just would be dishonest if I didn't say the part of the reason at the end of the day that I get out of bed is because it would be very selfish not to. And so there is this like moral reality to that, that I think, you know, and I saw that. I saw it with people close to me who have struggled with like really honestly like diagnosable serious mental health stuff. There was something empowering to them about just being needed and other people relying on them, that I guess what I'm saying is I think, well, I mean, one of them in particular, I think would just rather be miserable and out of bed than selfish and in bed. I think just sort of in the sense that I think your community relies on you, and there is something with continuing to just keep going with that. Now, I understand, I want to be sensitive that there's limits to that. I'm not saying like gut your way through a bout of depression or something, but I remember, you know, Eugene Peterson writes about a long period of depression and vocational just like sorrow in his work. He just did not want to be in the church he was in. He was having, and he didn't know what to do. He just felt stuck. And he literally just, he took up running and he just ran. Like that was the way that he dealt with it. But his narration of it is sort of like, well, these people still need me. I mean, I don't want to be here, but like my family needs me, my congregation needs me. And so there was a continuing to go for their sake. Anyway, but so there's spiritual, there's moral, there's physiological, there's practical. And then I think there's hopeful. I don't know the better word for that, because of course, spiritual and hopeful is the same, is that like there really is beauty in the world. There really is goodness. And I know I am the first one to know that there's a place that we descend to of bitterness and darkness where we kind of forget that. But at the same time, like it's objective. Like objectively, there is beautiful things to see in the world. There is art. There is rainstorms. There is good coffee. Like there are things to enjoy that we will miss if we just stay in bed. So there's delight to be had. Unfortunately, in order to experience that delight, you have to also put up with all kinds of pain. But that's the trade-off. I mean, you can't, if you wall yourself in your room or in your bed to not have the pain, then you won't actually experience any of the joy either. So that's the deal. I don't know.
That's beautiful.
Those are some reasons. That was just from this. I don't know.
No.
After this podcast, I'll be like, oh, wait, one more reason. I forgot.
Those are great reasons. Yeah, I'm reminded of this J.D. Salinger quote from Franny and Zooey, where he says, there are nice things in the world, and I mean nice things, and we're all such morons to get so sidetracked. I feel like that very often, where I just get lost in my own head. And I think you're exactly right to talk about that, our duty to our neighbor to love them by getting out of bed. And it's one of the things I talk about extensively in this book, because it is so important. And when we give into that despair, as you say, other people, it makes it easier for other people to give into despair. And I think one of the reasons we're hesitant to say that is that we don't want to put an additional burden on someone who's already feels like they got a rock on their chest and they
precisely
can't get out of bed.
Yeah, that was my hesitancy in saying it. I don't want people to feel like I'm just like, got it out or you're selfish. But at the same...
But there's purpose there too. And that's what that's what you got to, right? Is that, and when you are depressed and anxious and overwhelmed, one of the things, the first things it goes is a sense of purpose. You feel like your life lacks purpose. And so the flip side of this is you do have this purpose. And all you have to do to activate that, to walk, to live into that purpose is to put your feet on the ground and to stand up.
Yeah.
And that's beautiful. And that's exciting.
Yep, that's right. And sometimes the purpose doesn't become clear until you look back, whether the end of the day or the end of a year or the end of 5 years. I mean, I don't know how long that will take, but I think that there's, this is why Ignatian exercises help, is at the end of the day to say what was difficult or where was God's, a sense of God's distance today, and what was good, where was a sense of God's nearness or sense of God's beauty or sense of, or an experience of joy. It's really, really good for me to do that. I would say I when I was talking about things that I do when I'm noticing I'm really struggling, that I add in that exercise, because what I notice is like when I'm in that place, I don't really notice the joy. But then when I sit at the end of the day, if I press myself, I go, oh, well, even if it's really small, like I, you know, had a cookie at a coffee shop and that was good. Or like my daughter came and just put her head on my shoulder for a second, mm-hmm. you know, and then maybe she yelled at me or something like 10 minutes later, but there was that moment. There was that connection moment, you know?
Yes.
And some of this I think comes more naturally to certain type of people, but I have to sort of train my eyes to see goodness and beauty and joy, and to believe that it is just as real and just as true and just as solid, more solid than the other. This affects me as a writer all the time. Is, you know, you'll have 15 people say that your book changed their life, and then one person will not like it, and that's the only one you remember. But I think there is, what I was saying is that I think that it's not always that you feel the purpose in the moment that you're in it. You feel it's over time. You look back and go, oh, none of that was wasted. Like all of that was used in the mercy and grace of God.
I think one of the things that stuck with me the most, and that I hope that you will remember moving forward, is the importance of intentional communities. I'm currently processing her story of moving next to a friend so that her and her family can have a community. I'm still processing it myself because it's not something that I can do at this stage in my life, but there is something very right about that deep intentionality. So maybe I can't move, but maybe this inspires me to be more intentional about finding friends locally, because that's the next best option. I have a friend who will call me randomly on his way home from work, and I don't feel any guilt in not picking up the phone, because a lot of times I'm in a meeting or I'm in a podcast, but it's nice knowing that there's someone who cares enough to just give me a call without even texting to see if it's okay if they can call. Somebody who's not offended when I don't pick up, but someone who very clearly wants to know how I'm doing and is checking in on me. It means a lot, and I'm not entirely sure why I don't do it back, except that I'm afraid that I'll call at an inopportune time, and apparently maybe I need to get over that. I don't know. IVP is invested in advocating for mental health through the publications of books like On Getting Out of Bed by me, Alan Noble, and Prayer in the Night by Tish Harrison Warren. IVP provides Christian resources for both individuals and professionals. Find all of IVP's mental health resources at ivpress.com/mentalhealth.